Are you Invictus? Clint, are you Invictus? Are you Invictus?
What does it mean?
You know, when I started the Invictus Mind podcast, my goal was to unite a bunch of people who had a similar ideology or a similar characteristic traits. Invictus means unconquerable. It's an old Greek word for means unconquerable.
Unconquerable.
So, to be totally honest, it was a new concept to me. I had to Google it when you sent it to me. But yeah, I do my best.
Tell me about what the show, what is your audience looking for? Tell me.
This is your first time here. This is the number one program dedicated to helping individuals maximize their potential and truly become unconquerable. Here we have discussions about what it takes and what it means to experience and magnify political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
Yes, I would absolutely say that. I'm going to keep getting up, right? And I keep getting up and I keep pushing forward. And that's the type of mindset that you need to have.
I never lose hope. I never lose faith. My mindset has always been, if I want something, I don't give up.
So let me tell you what is the number one issue when it comes to being unconquerable.
Okay.
And the number one word you have to think about here is not intelligence, not savvy, not strength, none of those things. The number one thing is resilience.
You know I'm Invictus. Come on. All right. I'm Invictus AF.
Well, may I have an initiation question for my tribe?
Okay.
Are you Invictus?
I believe I am.
So yes, I agree. I am Invictus.
I totally agree, man. And I think that if there's anybody on this planet that's unconquerable, it's probably me. I am not the type to take orders, and I am definitely in a position that I can stand up for myself right now. So,
and I was like, no way, I know what that word means now.
yeah, man, very cool concept for a show.
You didn't ask me if I was Invictus.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Invictus Mind podcast. This is episode number 101, and I am your host, Mike Corbell. Now, I know what a few of you may be thinking. If you were looking at my catalog of episodes, I did go from episode 98, skipped over number 99, and then jumped right to 100 last week when I had my discussion with Tommy and Pete. Well, you wouldn't be wrong noticing that. I did numerically skip number 99. But since my very first episode was actually numbered 00, I did in fact have 100 recorded episodes for all you great folks out there. And just because my scheduling is off a little bit, and I thought it was much more attractive to feature both these gentlemen and call it episode 100 rather than episode 99. But I digress. We move on. This is a show where we discuss all things related to political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom. If this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you here. And if you like what we're doing, then please subscribe to whatever channel you're listening to and help promote the show by sharing it with three of your friends and or family members. All right. Well, today I invited a guest who I thought would make for a very interesting conversation. We did meet once again on podmatch.com. So if you want to check that out, I'll put the link in the show notes. Podmatch is a great resource for podcasters and guests who want to connect with each other. I'm going to let him introduce himself, but briefly, he is the author of a book entitled Finding Washington, Why America Needs to Rediscover the Virtues of Her Most Essential Founding Father. His name is Richard Raines. How are you doing today, Richard?
I'm doing great, Mike. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I definitely want to give you a chance to share your ideas about America's first president. However, I do want to make a full disclosure here, okay? I have a very eclectic audience, consisted of some libertarians, some anarchists, some Christians. They may have opposing views about Washington. Some of my audience is Christian, and they may have opposing views about what is called a righteous war, or some who are even pacifists who think that war in any cause is wrong and not very righteous. But, I do love having discussions about society and history and morality and theology, so I'm definitely interested in hearing your thoughts. And, I love you to share just a little bit about yourself and why you chose to write this book.
Yeah. Thanks for that. So, I do quite a few things. Among those, I'm a theology professor. I teach for a couple different schools. I teach world religions to, students at a state college here in Northeast Florida. And then I teach upper level theology courses and history of Christianity courses for for a private school, a private college, accredited college in New York. And so that occupies quite a bit of my time, quite a bit of my, you know, my free time is spent reading, you know, trying to prepare for lectures and things like that. I did take some time in 2020 during the quarantine. You know, you and I are on a video chat here, and I say in the book, and I say all the time, Zoom literally saved my job because my full-time job is not teaching. I'm an adjunct, which means I teach part-time, but didn't have as much time to interact with customers during the day. So found a lot of free time on my hands, and like a lot of people thought, man, I think I'll start a podcast. Couldn't figure out what to do a podcast on. So, I've been thinking about writing a book for a really long time. Knew that I had at least one book in me. I've always done a lot of freelance writing for religious news magazines. And I wrote back in the early 2000s, I wrote a newspaper column that ran in several papers in Georgia, which is where I'm from. And I ran for a few years and really enjoyed doing that. And so kind of knew I had a book in me. And really the sort of the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back was, even though I wrote the book in 2020, in 2016, after the Republican and Democratic presidential primary, as an evangelical Christian, I was not for the first time, and I've been in politics as well. I've been in elected politics, so I understand the political process and what it takes to get elected. And so for the not the first time, but certainly in 2016, after the primaries, I had the realization that I was left, and I say this in the book, and I just want to let you know and let your audience know that I am an equal opportunity offender when it comes to my next statement, because it inevitably makes about 85% of the people angry. But in 2016, this is my personal opinion, I felt like moving into November, I was left with the worst presidential candidate of my lifetime or the second worst presidential candidate of my lifetime. I had a choice between someone that I consider to be a traitor, that destroyed cell phones with a hammer to hide evidence, versus a guy that I didn't think I could leave alone with my daughters. So it got me thinking about our country. I think I mentioned I teach history of Christianity. That intersects with world history and American history significantly. And so have quite an affinity for American history and particularly revolutionary history. So I started looking back in our history at some of the people that I thought would be good for us to take a harder look at regarding sort of how to answer this problem of this rampant immorality that, from my perspective, is ongoing in our country. I think it's, even if you take my Christian worldview bias out of it, I do think that it's accurate to say that our culture is very immoral, very violent, over-sexualized, narcissistic. Just, I think that culturally we're not in a great place. And so this is not the first book that I wanted to write. I was going to write a book on the women who made America. And I was going to catalog all these women through American history that really helped shape our country. But I started with Martha Washington, started reading about George Washington. And even though I knew what I thought was quite a bit about George Washington, realized how little I actually knew. And Mike, the more I dug into George Washington, the more it became clear to me that that he exhibited the type of virtues and morality that I desperately want our country to revive and see a revival of. So the book, Finding Washington, Why America Needs to Rediscover the Values of Her Most Essential Founding Father, is stories from George Washington's life, many stories that most of us have never heard before. And then I highlight virtues that he displayed in those moments in his life, either letters he's written or things that he's done. And then I make an argument for why we need a revival of those virtues. Now, I do try to try very hard to approach this as a good historian, which is to say, not to get so caught up in the subject matter that I overlook some of the things about George Washington that aren't pretty. Mm-hmm. And so I do tackle what I consider to be Washington's greatest failure. I start the book with one of his failures, but later in the book, I discuss Washington as a slave owner, which in my opinion is his greatest failure. And I do discuss that a little bit, but that's the book really. And it's, I share my email throughout the book, richard@findingwashington.com, because I want the readers to really get involved with me in the discussion. In fact, I got an email last night from someone in Seattle, Washington. I don't know how this person found out about my book, because I live in the southeastern United States and most of the promotion has been right around, you know, the southeastern United States, but read it and sent me an email while I was in the middle of reading it. And so, but really my goal here, Mike, is to create a dialogue with other Americans. And I share how I think in business and politics and life and family and community, how we can renew and revive virtue in our culture. And I think that it's something our culture desperately needs.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you for that. I don't think you're going to find too many people who disagree with you about the 2016 election. And of course, we saw what happened in 2020 as well,
right,
which was probably just another repeat of it, or worse. Who knows? We have yet to see the total outcome of that. But I do want to share a cultural ideology with you. Although I am talking to you from Chicago, Illinois, born and raised a Midwesterner, I have family who resonates in the southeastern part of the United States. And so I have adopted some ideologies from that part of the world. And so I think that in many ways you are correct about the morality and just the culture of this this United States. And there's a lot of unfactual information out there, if we'll say it that way. You know, and you know, I'm gonna express my ignorance in front of my audience here by saying I have a limited knowledge about President Washington, only that offered in public education. I have a book sitting on my shelf. I think it's entitled His Excellency. I have yet to read it yet, but I definitely would like to hear your thoughts about George Washington. Although I like how you admitted that you know, he had some faults. Obviously, us living in a fallen world, I don't think it's prudent for us to put some of the men in our founding history up on pedestals like many people do. And so understanding that, you know, these are men of their times, men of their situation, called for specific reasons that they, you know, they have good virtues and poor virtues. But, you know, let's expound a little bit about what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mike. And I do think it's okay to laud them for the things they did. So if you think about those men and women that gathered, that put together this republic, it was some of the brightest minds of the Enlightenment. And not all of them were Christians in the sense that we understand evangelical Christianity today. I mean, I don't think that many people would say that Thomas Jefferson was a Christian. He was a deist. He wrote a Bible, Jefferson's Bible, where he essentially took out all the miracles of Jesus and said, here's the real Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, fathered kids with Sally Hemings, which was a slave. And I don't know how you say that that's not rape. You know what I mean? She was a slave. And again, I don't pretend to understand all of it. Benjamin Franklin's probably a deist. The author of Common Sense, Thomas Paine, was a deist, but not everybody and not even most were. But Washington, I don't really tackle this in the book as much, but when Washington was a kid, when I say a kid, 10, 11, 12 years old, he wrote a book of virtue. And he had all of these rules, Washington's rules, where do this, do that, do this. In other words, these are behaviors that if you adopt these behaviors, you're a virtuous person. So there was some influence in his early life that led him to think that pursuing virtue was a positive thing. Now, you know, you and I both went to public school, and I learned in elementary school, as a matter of historical fact, that George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. And then when his father asked him about it, he said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie." That is a fabricated story. There's nothing true about that story. Mm-hmm. But when Washington died, you had dozens of people across the country that were putting books and plays together to try to basically compensate themselves, capture the momentum of George Washington's life. And there was an author that created, fabricated these stories about George Washington. But some of the things that I learned about Washington, and perhaps if it's okay if I share my favorite story about George Washington, begins with an incredible failure. So Washington, this is prior to, you know, decades prior to the Revolutionary War. Washington was in the Virginia militia. He was a colonel in the Virginia militia. Most people don't know this, but George Washington is responsible for starting the French and Indian War, which was a war between Great Britain and the French that also involved Native Americans here in the North American continent. And so Washington was put in charge of Fort Necessity, which was in Ohio, which at that point was the western frontier of the colonies. And so Washington's out at Fort Necessity. He tries to engage the enemy some and decides he just needs to fortify his fort. He clears the area where the battle is going to take place, because if you remember in the 1700s, when armies would meet for battle, they would march into a big open space and then just shoot at each other, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how civilized warfare was done. Well, when the French and the Indians finally attacked, they were attacking from behind trees and stumps and decimated Washington's forces. A third of his men died. All the horses died. All the livestock were shot and killed. It was raining, so all the powder was wet. The men that were left over broke into the rum, and they were intoxicated. He had no one to fight. And the fighting stopped late in the evening. And someone delivered a wet note in French. Someone in Washington's, one of his men loosely interpreted it, didn't interpret it correctly, but loosely interpreted it, that said, "If you surrender and don't come back, we'll let you leave." So Washington was able to escape that. Well, if you fast forward several months, the war was going on then. The English sent over troops. And when General Braddock, who was an English general, came over, he was not happy with George Washington, didn't like him. The English really looked down on the colonists as rough and uncultured. And so Washington was trying to advise Braddock, "Hey, they're not going to fight fair. They're going to fight from behind trees and stumps and rocks. Please don't march these troops with these red coats through the forest, because you're going to get everybody killed." Mm. So Braddock essentially says, "You have no role here. You can stay back in the back with me as my aide-de-camp." An aide-de-camp was basically a really fancy way to say, "You're my helper." Mm. And so the redcoats go marching through the forest. They get to the Monongahela River, and they're clearing a path so they can cross the river. And the French and the Indians attack and start killing redcoats immediately. General Braddock is shot, falls from his horse, and the redcoats scatter. They're just running for their lives. Well, Washington, in that moment, gets off of his horse and sees to Braddock. Is caring for his wound and trying to take care of Braddock. And I say in the book that he is the aide-de-camp of the century, because mm-hmm. there's bullets flying everywhere and he doesn't fight back. He gets off his horse and he does his job, which is to assist Braddock. So Braddock looks around. He doesn't see any other officers. He sees his men running. The only thing, the closest to an officer that he sees is this militia guy, right? This colonel in the militia, George Washington. And he says to Washington, "I want you to mount a defense and I want you to rally the troops." And Washington, that's all he needed. He got on his horse. Now, Washington was 6'2", Mike. Mm-hmm. And the average height of someone from Europe and that lived in the colonies in the 1700s was 5'8". So when Washington got on his horse, he was at least 8 foot off the ground, a perfect target for anybody that could shoot a rifle. So for 12 hours, Washington mounts a defense, finally driving back the French and the Indians. During the course of that battle, Washington has two horses shot out from under him. He's on his third horse. And when he takes his coat off that evening, he's got four bullet holes in his coat.
Oh, wow.
Now, the English finally win the French and Indian War. And years later, he's traveling to Ohio with a physician friend of his, because as an officer, he's given land in Ohio. And so he gets there, he's looking at his land, and he's invited to a meeting with all of the local Native American chiefs. He goes to the meeting, and all of these chiefs sitting around the fire all know who he is. That's why they invited him. And the reason they know who he was, because they said all of them were at the Battle of Monongahela, and they all deliberately fired at him, and no one could hit him. And so when the battle was over, the Indians went back, told stories of George Washington, and then the religious leaders among the Native Americans issued a prophecy about George Washington, saying that this warrior will be the father of a great nation. Now that's like a colonel on the beach on D-Day in Normandy. Mm-hmm. Making such an impact on German soldiers that when they go back to their base, they write a song about the American soldier. So all of that story, I think, highlights several virtues. One of the virtues I think that he highlights that is how he recovers from failure. Failure doesn't define him. He recovers. The other thing that I think that he exhibits, and that is servant leadership. He knows the French are going to attack. He knows how they're going to attack and kind of knows where they're going to attack. But instead of pleading his case, instead of demanding his rights, he becomes the aide-de-camp of the century and does his job the way he's supposed to do it. And through his servant leadership, he's then given a chance to lead. And did you know, Mike, that Fort Necessity surrender is the last time George Washington would ever surrender troops for the rest of his military career? So it's stories like that I highlight through the book and talk about virtues that he displayed, and then, you know, make an argument that we need more integrity, make an argument that we need to stop being so afraid of failure. Failure is how we, Mike, failure is how we win. I've got five kids, and I remember when he's now 16, when he was, 7 years old and learning to throw a baseball, I'd stand 10 yards from the kid and he'd throw the baseball 20 yards to my right. And I'm like, come on, throw the ball. Well, now the kid can throw a ball great, right? But it's the point that I would make with him was, look, the best person to ever throw a baseball stunk at it until they didn't. So I want us to stop being so afraid of failure in our culture. So things like that. But yeah, that's probably my favorite story about Washington. And there's a lot more than that.
Yeah, I remember learning a little bit about the French and Indian War in school, but never any stories about Washington in that battle, right, in that war. I was always, the one thing that sticks out is when he was crossing the Delaware River and his men were on the virtue of starvation, and they had to eat their shoes to survive, and he rallied them, to keep going. So you know that he wasn't a quitter, but I like that story that you shared there.
Yeah, so he and that's true. When they crossed the Delaware River on Christmas night, his troops were starving. He had men that froze to death on that trip. They think about that. I've been cold before, and I know it gets cold in the Midwest where you're from. But mm-hmm. Can you imagine not having shoes? His men didn't. A significant number of his men didn't have enough clothing to cover what he considered their nakedness, which would have been their private parts, right? They were just, their clothes were tattered. The only thing they had to eat was they managed to get flour, and they would just take flour with water, make cakes, and put the cakes on top of the ashes and cook these cakes, and then they'd have to brush the ashes off and eat them. So his ability to inspire his troops is another virtue that he displayed, because these men, when they got ready to cross the Delaware, in December, most of these men, their time in the Continental Army was up in January. These men could have revolted and said, no, we just want to go home. But he inspired his men to cross that river and go into Trenton. And it turned the war effort around, for sure.
Right. I think that of the two most prominent virtues that I can recall from my education about him is, number one, he had supreme authority of the army in the American Revolution. And rather than, you know, taking a post right away, he was hesitant to, lead the new nation. Right. And when he called, when he was called to be president, when he was elected to be president, rather, you know, he set a precedent for saying, I'm only going to run, you know, 2 4-year terms and that's it. I'm going to step down. So a lot of people say that was the first time in history that such a powerful person gave up absolute power. And he did because he went to go home and retire, you know?
Yeah. So it's even bigger than that. That's certainly true, but I want you to think about the way the world did things in the 1700s. Mm-hmm. Countries were ran by sovereigns or kings or emperors or whatever. And so in Europe, kings, the King of England, King of France, King of Denmark, right? Kings ruled by what they call divine right, meaning that God had given them the right to rule, and they ruled, and whatever decisions they made were a product of their divine sovereignty that they had been granted by God, right? That was the way that every European lived under that system. But in 1776, the framers of the Declaration of Independence, they said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. So what the framers of the Declaration of Independence said was, we know you think you rule by divine right, but we're telling you that we have a divine right to be individually free and govern ourselves. So it was two competing, really, theologies, Mike. It was two competing perspectives of divinity, really. So for Washington to willingly step down was the capstone of that belief. And even King George commented that him stepping down made him one of the most powerful people in the world. I forget the exact verbiage, but the world recognized that. When he said, no, 8 years is enough, the world gasped. Mm. And now think about it. Where do you have a king in the world? You have dictators, right? You have a king in Saudi Arabia. You have some kings, you know, the king of Jordan. But in the Western world, those events that sort of the crescendo was Washington stepping down is what convinced the world to self-govern and get rid of monarchs.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversations that I find myself into on Twitter and other places about the Enlightenment philosophy. You talked about the theology of, you know, divine right of kings versus self-government. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to necessarily go down that rabbit hole, but you know, for the sake of some of my libertarian friends or my Christian libertarian friends, there's this idea that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, there was a revolution and George Washington stepped down, you know, we did have a new government that started. And eventually that presidency, that role of presidency, has been very much skewed to the fact that we have almost an imperial presidency nowadays, right?
Yeah, certainly. You know, if you can get enough political power in this country, you are effectively immune from any sort of prosecution. I think that I'm not going to go down that road either, but there are a lot of people that would be in jail today if they were me or you, right? People without any sort of political power. So I do think there needs to be a reset of the political system, and I'm not happy with the state of things for sure. But I'm trying to keep my conversation, even though I have a lot of pretty strong political opinions, I'm trying to keep my conversation here based on virtue and morality. Because regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, you know, that thing, and here's sort of the way that I say that. Like most people don't realize that that, you know, George Washington, he didn't belong to a political party. He's kind of the father of federalism, but let's just skip that for a second. He didn't officially belong to a party, and he eschewed that. He didn't want us to have parties, but every other president since him has been part of a political party. Well, when we think about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, you know, we think of, and John Quincy Adams, we don't think about them in terms of being, you know, a member of a political party. We just think of them as founding fathers, right? But when you think about, you know, it's possible that for our generation, John Kennedy might have been the last president that we've had that really sort of transcended any sort of party politics, even though he was, you know, solidly a Democrat. And, you know, there was a lot of internal political things that helped get him elected, but he seemed to sort of transcend that. But every president since then were pretty solidly identified with a political party. And it's just getting worse, right? It's creating tribalism is what it's creating.
Well, wasn't it Washington who rejected political parties and warned the country about political factions and how it would actually destroy the system that he had in mind?
He did. He sure did. But I will say this, though. You know, I don't know that. I'll tell you something about libertarian. You've mentioned libertarian a couple of times. When I was in politics, when I was running for my very first office, the very first election I was running in, my Facebook page at the time said something about my political beliefs. It said conservative, darn near libertarian. Well, a guy that was running against me in the Republican primary didn't know what a libertarian was. Mm-hmm. But he took an ad out on the front page of a local newspaper. It was below the fold, but it was on the front page. Said Richard Raines, self-declared libertarian. Mm. And the poor guy, I demolished the guy in the Republican primary because about a third of the conservatives in my county in Georgia voted for me because they thought I was, you know, well, that's a good thing, right? So, I have libertarian leanings. But Washington would not have been a libertarian. The system that we developed after the Revolutionary War was the Articles of Confederation, very, mm-hmm. very weak national government or federal government and a very strong state government. And we almost died as a country as a part of it. And I'll tell you this, and I bet a lot of your listeners probably don't know this, Mike, but when we say George Washington is the father of our country, he's literally the father of our current republic. And I'll tell you how. So after the Articles of Confederation, everybody went home, right? He lives in Virginia, and he was serving on a committee. He was the head of a committee that was proposing to dig a canal to connect the Potomac and Ohio rivers. Hmm. Right? This would have made the Ohio River traffic, this you could have gotten goods to the ocean, right? It was a canal, a very big undertaking. And it was him, and it was Madison, and it was Hamilton. And they would all have their meetings at Mount Vernon. Well, when they would come to Mount Vernon, they would inevitably talk politics. And George Washington came up with the idea to have a constitutional convention. But they didn't think that the people would go for it. So they said, well, let's invite all the states to a meeting about this canal. And at this meeting at this canal, we'll just bring up the idea of the deficiencies in our Articles of Confederation. Well, that's what they did. And not all the states came. But once it turned into a constitutional convention, all the states came. Okay, let's have a constitutional convention. Who's going to lead this thing? And they're like, well, the only person that could lead it is George Washington. So they made George Washington the president of the constitutional convention. They hammered out a constitution, got it ratified, became a nation. And literally, the only choice as far as all the states were concerned, the only choice for the first president was George Washington. It wasn't even really a major question. So when we say George Washington is the father of our nation, he really is. And through all of that, he exposes quite a bit of humility. And in his letters to Martha, you can read that he's not asking for any of this and would, if he thought there was any way he could, he would not do it. But he felt he referred to God as providence. That was another name he had for God, providence. He saw it as a matter of providence that he accept his role to be the commander of the Continental Army, to be the president of the Continental Congress, or the Constitutional Convention, and to ultimately be the first president of the United States.
Interesting. Yeah, there are some who will probably disagree that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, was written away or declared in a good way. Some people I've heard say that it was a coup. Some people say that there was a lot of very bad motives behind the Constitution, and a lot of things that that ultimately led to the country where we are today. So that's just my little push it back for you right there, you know. But one thing that I noticed that when George Washington was president, and maybe we can dive down this a little bit further. I'm thinking of the Whiskey Rebellion.
So I didn't dig into his life post presidency. All of my research, the only really post revolution research that I did was Shays Rebellion. That was something that really alerted Washington that he needed to, that he felt like we needed a stronger national government. And his argument for a stronger national government didn't start once the Revolutionary War ended. It started during the Revolutionary War, mm-hmm. because he saw the ineffectiveness of not having a strong national government to run a war. Because the states were sending soldiers based on what they thought they could send. And so so I didn't really dig into to his life post-presidency, except for the time that he spent at Mount Vernon with Lafayette. And it was really Lafayette that turned Washington in terms of how he viewed slavery. And so really, that's really the only research I did, because I wanted to look at Washington, the slave owner. I wanted to find out, you know, because here's what I get, right? I'll give you a for instance. So I'm out here trying to sell this book, and I'm running ads on social media. And I ran an ad on Twitter right after launch, which was in May, late May, right around Memorial Day. It's really June. And so, you know, I had some header about Washington and whatever. And then I spent $100 to run an ad that ran for 5 days, and it mm-hmm. was seen by like 20,000 people or something like that. And people are really angry that I wrote a book about George Washington, because I'd get these comments like, if this book is about George Washington, it should be burned. That's what somebody said to me. And the only thing people could say is that Washington owned slaves, Washington owned slaves, Washington owned slaves. And so I'm glad that I tackled that in the book, because the question I wanted to answer, Mike, is that all he was? Or, okay, so he was a slave owner, but does that mean that that discounts every other good thing that he did? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a legitimate question. That is a great historical question, because, you know, we're tearing down statues and things like that. And so one of the things that I noticed about Washington, and I say this in the book, I spend quite a bit of time talking about it in the book, that there's no way around it. Washington owned other people. He was a slave owner. It's one of the most evil, despicable things that you could possibly say about another human being. There are people that write books about George Washington that try to brush over that. You know, they'll say things like, well, you know, he released his slaves in his will. No, he didn't. He did, but he didn't. So Washington, in his will, said that when Martha dies, they can all be free. So essentially, he was saying, well, once we don't need them anymore, they can be free. I don't think you get any credit for that. At some point, Washington realized that the slave trade was immoral. So he stopped buying and selling slaves, which meant that when his slaves would get married and when his slaves would have children, he was responsible for taking care of those. And so it almost ruined him financially. I think that's a good thing that you stop buying and selling people, but his slaves were still slaves. Mm-hmm. I don't think you get any credit for that. He treated his slaves very well. He didn't abuse his slaves. He treated them very well. I don't think you get any credit for that. You know, we would not say to a rapist, you get a lesser sentence because you told the victim you loved her, right? That's kind of how I view that. Mm. So Washington failed his slaves and he failed his country by being a slave owner. Now, he and Lafayette were working on a plan to abolish slavery. And the plan that they had for abolishing slavery was to buy plantation land in West Indies, send all the slaves to West Indies and let them sharecrop and have freedom. That was his idea. It didn't come to pass. None of that worked out. And he died before that happened. But one of the interesting things about Washington as a slave owner that I found was that there was a former slave in, I think it was in New York State. Phyllis Wheatley was her name. Mm. And Phyllis Wheatley wrote a poem about George Washington thanking God for him. Now you have George Washington, a slave owner, and Phyllis Wheatley, a former slave, writing a poem and thanking God for a slave owner. Now, I think what that shows is that shows that in the 1700s, the issue of slavery certainly had Americans divided. And to some extent, slavery was a part of the fabric of the nation that most people knew needed to end. But I don't think you can judge George Washington. I don't think you can say that he never did anything good because he was a slave owner. And that's not how you do history anyway. And I'll tell you what I do. I use the issue of abortion to make my point. Now, there are two extremes to the abortion issue. Hmm. On one extreme is the more abortions, the better. And let's make sure women can get abortions regardless, like give them coat hangers if you have to. Let's kill these babies. That's one extreme. Mm-hmm. That was Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. Let's just kill black people. That was basically what her goal was. And then you have the other extreme, which is me, which I think abortion is the modern day Holocaust. Those are the two extremes. Now, most Americans are somewhere in the middle where they're like, okay, women should get abortions if they need it, but let's try to limit abortions. That's how slavery was in the United States in the 1700s. Let's try to end it. Let's try to mitigate it. It's a bad thing, but let's just try to mitigate slavery. Well, what if 200 years goes by and we discover medical definitive proof that life begins at conception? Hmm. You can't argue with the proof. It's there. We have pictures. We have everything you need. And then our society says, okay, anybody who supported abortion on any level, we're gonna destroy them historically. Any president that even mentioned that they were for abortion, even in extreme cases of rape and incest, we're gonna tear their statues down. Any actor that gave an award speech that said, let's support abortion, we're gonna posthumously revoke their Academy Award. And we're going to wipe these people from the history books because they supported abortion. Well, average Americans today would say, well, that doesn't really reflect my views. Mm-hmm. Right? I think that's how we have to look at slavery. Thank God we finally got rid of slavery. But I think that if you want to tear a statue of George Washington down, because he was a slave owner, then if you ever buy another product from China, you're a hypocrite. Right?
You make a good point there.
If you consume internet pornography, but you want to tear a statue of Thomas Jefferson down because of slavery, you are a hypocrite, because human trafficking, modern human trafficking, dwarfs the size of the North Atlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. So what do? Right? Do we stand on our high horse and do we say that I'm going to pick this one issue to ruin people's lives over? Or do we say there was a historical context in which slavery existed? It stunk and it's an evil, but that's not all these people were. So that's really my take on slavery.
And I think that's a fair take, because obviously when you bring up slavery and you bring up abortion, those are two very loaded issues, and they're there with the purpose of dividing people, which is why there's such a political issue right now.
Yeah.
And as I started, I said, you know, humanity has both good and bad. Every single one of us, you know, as a Christian theology professor, you should know that we live in a fallen world, that we all have temptations of good and evil. And according to history, there are some very dark times in history. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there weren't good people in history that did things that pushed the needle a certain direction to you know, welcome the gospel, if you would. You know, some very prominent men throughout history did some bad things. But if, like you said, if we only focus on that bad, then we are overlooking all the good stuff that came out of that. So I agree with you in that aspect.
Yeah, I don't know why we can't just say both are true. George Washington, even among his peers, was a model of virtue. And that was what every person in the country thought about the guy. He was the most bulletproof politician to have ever lived. He could have been king of the United States if he wanted to. And so when he died, people couldn't write books and plays about him enough. They couldn't say enough good things about him. And he has been a model for virtue for over 200 years for Americans. And I think you can say both, Mike. I think you can say that George Washington was a model of virtue, but he was also a man of his era, and he participated in the evil of slavery. Mm-hmm. I think both are true.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I want to reference something that you mentioned, because obviously when you're looking at Washington being a man of his times, being the first president of the United States, and then you made reference to the year 2016. We had two very awful choices. Where do you think it went wrong? Is it just the culture of society in general? Is it the understanding of power in politics? Or, you know, is it a combination of both? How do you think we go from a man like George Washington, despite his flaws, to men like Joe Biden and Donald Trump?
So I think that's a... I don't think it's a simple answer, and I think it is a multifaceted answer, and I'll try to address some of those facets. Number one, we have a high tolerance for immorality, and the tolerance is getting greater and greater. So there's that. So we tolerate immorality. Could you imagine if Democrat or Republican, could you imagine if the United States found out that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's son was soliciting prostitutes and making movies about his drug use? Mm. Can you imagine the bipartisan calls for that versus we see what Hunter Biden's done and we're like, mm-hmm. Right? So I think that we are a more immoral culture. Secondly, and I think this is a big part of it. So good people will make concessions on things that they consider non-essential to keep the peace. So good people, listen, the average person listening to your podcast, Mike, wants to go to work and come home and raise their family and be left alone, mm-hmm. Right? That's what they want. They just want to be left alone. They don't want to have to pay $5 at the pump. They don't want to be taxed out the wazoo. They just, and they don't want the government peeking in their front door. They just want to be left alone, right? The average person. And in the pursuit of being peaceful people, the average person will make concessions if they think it gives them peace. But what they don't understand is that the people on the other side of that will never be happy with the concessions until they have all of our freedom. And I think that's a problem. So now you've gotten to a point, Mike, where people like me, maybe like you, I don't know you personally, but I would imagine the average American is getting to a point where they're like, okay, now you're telling me what to say. Now you're taking the language away from me. Like, I'll concede this over here. I'll let you, you know, I'll let you put graphic nudity in movies. I just won't watch them, right? I'll let you do this, but I just won't participate. But now what you're saying is that I have to change my speech for you. I have to call men women and women men, and I have to pretend along with you for peace. And I think what you're getting to in our country is you're getting to a place where we're not willing to concede anymore, and they're not used to the pushback. They're used to the concessions. And so that's happening at the same time. So your original question is, how did we get from George Washington to here? I think we've become increasingly immoral. I think there's too much money in politics. I think the 24-hour news cycle is ruining us because sensationalism is what sells, and bad news is what sells, right? You don't pick up your local newspaper and you don't see the headline above the fold, Timmy's dog saves a chicken, right? You don't see the good news. You don't see grandma's 90 and she hasn't fallen today, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the news you get. You don't get, my son stopped doing drugs. You know, my daughter is not sexually promiscuous, right? Those aren't the headlines. The headlines are all the negative stuff. And it just, the negativity, I think it ruins us. And so money in politics is a problem. Immorality in our culture is a problem. The 24-hour news cycle is a problem. And the fact that good people have conceded so much that the people who hate us for being good people think that they deserve the concessions. And if we push back any at all, it looks like war. So that's just my nickel's worth of opinion on that.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying there. And, you know, so I've often questioned from my own curiosity, what men of power, you know, you mentioned media, you know, and the headlines coming up in social, and, you know, we always get the bad news to us. But then I think of the natural circulation, as Pareto would call it, the circulation of the elites. Mm-hmm. Men with power are the only ones that can fight back other men with power. So you get a revolution, just an exchange of power there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, obviously, we're talking about Washington and his virtues and being that able to set that precedent for, you know, giving up that power. And the U.S. Constitution is unique in the fact that it says, okay, this is a way that we can actually peacefully transition from one powerful, you know, entity to another. It's unique in world history, although there's a lot of countries out there who have adopted similar patterns after that.
Right.
But my question is about men like Washington, some of the founding fathers. I'm not saying that they weren't all virtuous. I'm not saying that they were all bad, you know, given the fact of the men of their times. I guess I'm trying to come to this question as I'm speaking it to you. I wonder how I can say this. If we can see the news now, we can say there's a lot of things like fake news, right? Mm-hmm. If men of power are doing awful, despicable things now, and history is saying, well, if you can't say anything bad about them, that's fake news. If the modern media is saying that, how can we be sure that history hasn't covered up some of those dark spots?
Well, I would say, Mike, that you could probably bet your next paycheck that since we've had a for-profit media, a large-scale media in this country, probably since the 30s or 40s, if you want to go back that far, where these large media machines gained power, right, then I would say that they get to write the history because they get to cover up. They get to cast the good guys and the bad guys, right? So I don't think that we are even remotely. Well, I take that back. So your podcast, right? This medium, what you and I are doing is replacing the conglomerate media in terms of people telling the truth, right? It's just that the New York Times might have millions of readers and you might have thousands of subscribers. But there's 2 million podcasts out there, and probably half of those 2 million are doing something like this. Mm-hmm. So I don't think all is lost. But Mike, I don't get my news from the newspapers anymore. I don't know who to trust. I don't get my news from CNN or MSNBC or Fox even. I don't really, it's very difficult to get the true news. And so you end up having to go places like this where people don't have a fiduciary reason to just tell their version of the truth. But I will tell you that probably since media became a way to wealth instead of a way to report truth, that you have to be somewhat suspect of what you read. And for somebody like me that's a historian, boy, those are tough words to say, for sure, because how can I even trust the research that I've done, right? Mm-hmm. It's easier when it's George Washington, right? Because you didn't have that. You could trust what that local newspaper said because they would save their biting and snarling for the editorial. The rest of it was straight down the line reporting, right? So, but the media is that we have a problem. We have a real problem. And so, yeah, that makes it tough to know. I guess if the media is reporting corruption, you can bet that whatever they're not reporting is the iceberg under the water. Mm. Right? Like, how do you go to Congress? Right? How we'll take Bernie Sanders, for instance. Forget about the fact that he's, you know, a political hot topic. People either love the guy or hate him. But the only thing Bernie Sanders has ever done, ever, is just serve in politics. The guy's a millionaire. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? How do you do that, Mike? How do you go to Congress? You make $175,000 a year plus a housing allowance and some other allowances that you get for travel. How do you go and how do you come out 25 years later a millionaire? Right? How do you do that? That's the iceberg under the water, right? And so I think as long as you can achieve wealth and power through politics and the media can line their pockets by manipulating that and covering that up, then I tell you what I worry about, Mike. And this is, I'm just baring my soul here. We are more divided right now than we were at the beginning of the Civil War. There's two differences. We're not divided over a singular issue like we were in the Civil War. And we're not divided along state lines like we were in the Civil War. We are divided ideologically, which is much more dangerous. And so I'm trying to think of a peaceful way back. And I think the peaceful way back is for me and you and business owners and teachers and farmers and sales representatives and people that are out here living their lives and working for a living to revive virtue. That's what I think. That's a long way back.
Yeah.
But there are other options. And I am so afraid, Mike, that at some point the people that have been pushing against us for all these years and demanding concessions are finally going to say to Americans, you know what? You're not allowed to talk anymore and give us your guns. And Mike, when they do that, when they say you can't have guns anymore, the 300 million guns that exist in this country are going to be used to push back against the government. And I think we are on the precipice of another civil war. And that sounds so fanatical to even say. But when you talk to people, people are angry, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
They're extremely angry. And they're not just angry. They're angry with no recourse. With what do I do, right? Do I just take it? Well, I think people are tired of taking it. So my argument is, next time you go to the ballot box, vote for integrity and not party.
Mm.
Whoever the candidate is with the most integrity, vote for them. If you are passionate about building a wall on the southern border, let's just use that as an example. And there are two candidates, and one candidate is a scum-sucking liar, and they want a border wall. And the other one is of high integrity and loves their family and tries to do what's right and doesn't want a border wall. I'm telling you to choose integrity before you choose a political issue, because choosing people with integrity is the only way to turn this around. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying if you're in a position to fill positions at your job, choose the person with the most integrity. When you're in a position to advance people in your company into management, I'm telling you, choose integrity first.
Sure.
Choose people with integrity first. The only way we're going to turn this around without some sort of civil war is for us to revive virtue and become virtuous people again, so that when we do disagree, we can disagree without wanting to choke each other.
I think I agree with that sentiment as well there, Richard. And I want to end with this. You know, unfortunately, in today's world, we have so many people who are just trying to revise history. And I think that there have been great men and women in our history, in our past, that deserve the reverence that they should get. Although, like I said, maybe not put them up on a pedestal, be aware of the situations of their times, but identify the good values, the good virtues, and character traits that they have. And I think you're doing a good job, you know, teaching correct principles, teaching good values, and using men that people can. They have some kind of knowledge about, because yes, I think that if the modern culture continues to paint with a black paintbrush over all the past characters of this country, then we're not going to know what we used to be, what we came from, and going forward is just going to be bleak.
So, yeah, I don't disagree. So I have, I think, a possible solution. Maybe your readers will get the book, Finding Washington. You can get it online, go to Amazon. And Mike, I'm just going to ask your listeners to do me a big favor. If you buy the book and you like it, give it to someone, or buy someone else a copy and give it to them. Nobody's getting rich writing books. You don't make any money really off books. So this is not about money.
Mm-hmm.
But my email, richard@findingwashington.com. When you're reading the book, send me an email with your ideas and the things that you think. But I hope your readers will get a copy. And Mike, I'm so grateful that you had me on today. I enjoyed this. And man, I could talk about this stuff all day.
Yeah, me too. That's why I have a podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Since you gave your plugs already, I don't have to ask you for that. I appreciate that. And if you can maybe say one last thing as far as George Washington, just to kind of leave on a good note, and we'll end there.
So one of the things that George Washington said to the Constitutional Convention when they were trying to hammer out some different things, and they were divided, big states versus small states, southern states versus northern states, George Washington had everyone sit down. He stood up and he addressed the Constitutional Convention, and he said, and I'm going to read here, "To please all is impossible, and to attempt it would be in vain. The only way, therefore, is to form such a government as will bear the scrutinizing eye of criticism," and here's where we come in, "and trust it to good sense and patriotism of the people to carry it into effect." George Washington had hope in us to have good sense. That's one. You can't be a functional idiot. So to have good sense and patriotism. Patriotism means I love this place, even if it's not as great as it used to be, or even what I think it should be. I love this place. So George Washington had hope. And so I think that's what we need to have more of is hope. And so that's what I'll leave you with today.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. I think that hope is one of those strong virtues that we need to have. So stick on the line here, Richard. I'm going to end the recording right now, but I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.